people would just directly say to me, how does my student be able to engage in this problem if they don't know their facts? And I think out of all the things that I hear, that one breaks my heart, because somehow we're equating computational and memorization with be able to think, be able to enjoy mathematics.
Hi, and welcome back to another episode of Math Teacher Lounge. I'm Bethany Lockhart Johnson.
And I'm Dan Meyer. Great to see you folks here. Hi, Bethany.
Hi, we are on episode 10 of this season, all about fluency. And, you know, I gotta say, we started out this whole season talking about how you felt about fluency. I'm not ready yet, Dan, to hear how far you've come. But I just want to say that, like, the guest we have today, if no one else can convince you about the power of fluency, it's this guest.
Yeah, I feel like me and this guest, and I will not be mysterious about it, it's Fawn Nguyen, fan favorite, second time appearance, that I feel like Fawn and I come from a bit of a similar tradition in that we, like, both appreciate problem solving, mathematical modeling, thinking that isn't often easily captured in, like, let's just say a math drill worksheet. So I feel like I we've recruited onto the show today someone with whom, like, I'll be on the same frequency with Fawn. And I hope to learn a little about how Fawn sees fluency and problem solving and how they relate.
Well, that's exactly what I mean. Like, I feel like there's something about the way you both talk about math and problem solving that will just, like, finally be like, oh, I'll listen to you, Fawn, not Bethany.
right.
Not our other fantastic experts and thinkers. Fawn, got you.
Fawn, though, yeah.
Fawn but has, Fawn, though, yeah, yeah. We're both fans. And, hey, so before we dive in, though, how are you doing? How is the world of fluency in your first graders' lives?
Right. Thank you for asking. We are coming up on the end of the first semester, and I would say my approach to fluency from day one to day whatever we're at, day 100 or so, has changed a lot over the course of this season, you know, through learning with experts here on the show, through learning with you. I find myself much more excited to inject elements into fluency work with my kids that are gamey, that involve choice, that involve thinking about structures that try to help, like, properties of math emerge that aren't just like the numerical answers on the paper. And so I would say I'm people are generally pretty math positive around here still in kinder and first, so we'll take that for a win. People aren't freaked out by seeing numbers, and we still have some conversations here and there that are, you know, kind of creative and fun. So I'm loving it. Thank you for your help with that.
Hey, I gotta say, I was hoping I'd get far more texts from you featuring, like, images of you all mid-gameplay. But I understand you're so in it that you're not even thinking about, you know what, I should share this magic fluency moment with Bethany. But I'm happy to hear it's going well.
Yeah, it has been. Careful with that, what you wish for there, because I might just FaceTime you in and have you teach my kids every afternoon, or try to anyway. So watch out with that.
Having met your children, I would be delighted to. I would be delighted to. So we're bringing back Fawn. Now, Fawn joined us season two of the show. Season two, Dan.
Season two.
That's when we were on video.
Yes, we had characters in our drama that were still alive. Like, there's some major plot points that hadn't yet been revealed in our drama that is Math Teacher Lounge back in season two. We were talking to Fawn about, was it problem solving then? I want to say it was problem solving.
Yeah, for sure. And it was, you know, we got such good feedback about it.
Yeah. So if you were not around in season two, or for some reason don't know about Fawn, let me just tell you a bit about Fawn. Fawn is currently a specialist on the math teaching and learning team here at Amplify. But in Fawn's career, Fawn's, I think, better known as a math teacher. And certainly, like, a capital M, capital T math teacher, a math teacher's teacher. Fawn loves the work as much or more than anyone I've ever met. Teachers will attend Fawn sessions around the world and will just vibe with her immediately for lots of reasons. But I think a lot of it is just that she really gets the work and presents as someone who has done the work for a very long time, knows what kids are like, knows what math teaching is like. And it's just very, I guess, authentic is an overused word, but I think Fawn is one of the most authentic math teacher types I know. And Fawn has also done work as a math teacher coach, in case that wasn't, super obvious from the intro there. So yeah, just really excited to have Fawn back on the show and to help you folks and all of us learn about how fluency and problem solving, which I have had in my head as somewhat, you know, antagonistic, as somewhat like unfriendly to one another, to help us, and especially me, learn how they relate. So please welcome Fawn back on the show. Hey, Fawn, good to see you again.
Hey, hey, Dan. Hi, Bethany. Oh my God, I finally get to talk.
Hello.
My goodness, yeah. 20 minutes in.
That's a great intro to Fawn. Yeah, the Fawn vibe right there. Thank you, Fawn. All right. Yeah, we'll go shorter next time. Yeah, good to see you.
Great to see you guys.
Welcome to the show, Fawn.
Thank you for having me. Yeah, it's always a pleasure.
So we have been asking all of our guests, if there is an area of your life beyond mathematics where you're currently building fluency.
I know I heard some others. I've been listening, and it's baking. Bake a baguette, not just any baking. I love to cook. I love to cook, and so on the stovetop, I'm pretty good. But yeah, baking is another beast. But baguette, and someone told me that actually is the measure, the quantitative measure of the chef, right? The one who really knows. And well, no wonder I've been, yeah, it's tough. It's tough. There's too many moving parts, too many variables. And I don't think I have the right water, I feel like, because I've tried everything. So it's baking a baguette.
We've had some chats about, making roast chicken with Jason Zimba, and now French baguettes with Fawn Nguyen. We have like a real, we can pivot to a different kind of podcast here, Bethany, pretty right, easily, yeah. I think. Yeah.
We have a channel for cooking.
I love hearing about what folks are working on. Yeah, and I think it just helps us broaden our definition of fluency. And I also think it helps us remember that we're all learning. It's all about learning. And we all have things that, you know, maybe we are fluent in our math facts, and so it could be hard to relate to the topic. But then when you remember there's things that you're brand new at too, it can help kind of ground your work and your thinking and remind you what it's like to be a beginner. So we have so much we want to talk to you about, but I have one more baguette question. What would you say, like thinking about one of the first baguettes that you made, right?
Right.
And compared to like what you are putting on the table now, how has that process changed, or how has that, like, your thinking about the process changed?
Right. I definitely have improved. For example, I've got, you know, the proofing down. So yeah, there's definitely, I can, you know, I wish I did the before picture, right, gradually, because I'm definitely getting better. So now, like I mentioned, maybe it's just the water is that one part that's not quite perfect. But otherwise, yeah, I mean, you know, made leaps and bounds. So we get better at something we spent a lot of time on.
We are so excited to talk to you because, one, you're fantastic. And two, you're an expert on problem solving. Before we delve into the nitty gritty, I'm just curious, at a high level, how does an enthusiast on problem solving think about fluency?
Well, first, anytime I hear the word fluency, it always takes me to the context of what it means to be fluent in a language, because I'm an English learner, right? So to have flow, not stumbling, not being stuck. And I finally can make a claim like 2 days ago that I can speak English fluently. I mean, it's just, right? So I will always be an English learner. I feel like that. And now sadly, however, I have to say I was just in Vietnam last month, and I am no longer fluent in Vietnamese, right? Because I spent so much time, I left when I was so early, I spent so much time trying to learn English.
Oh,
and now
wow.
That I have it, yeah, so I can't say I'm fluent in Vietnamese anymore. You know what's weird though, Bethany and Dan, is I woke up one morning, and I wish I'd written down the date. I woke up one morning and realized my thoughts were in English. My thoughts in English. Right? It's a language I'm trying to learn. I'm trying to learn. I want to get this right. And then all of a sudden, it's like, wow, my thoughts are in English. So
Oh, wow. That's
when I knew I'd switched over. It's weird. Right. Now, you know, what remains completely intact, however, completely intact, is my times table is in Vietnamese. Because I had learned that in Vietnamese, right? So even though I've, you know, yeah, maybe this had everything to do with it, which was it was literally beaten into me. And I've shared this story hundreds of times. And you can ask any Vietnamese who went to Catholic school. So we would stand And so we'd all stand up with our palm face up like this, one palm face up as we all stand. And the teacher would walk around with a stick to hit us and just point at us and say, like, you know, 7 times 8. And if the answer does not come promptly, you know, automatically, well, then we get hit. The problem is, well, it hurts a lot, but the problem is what normally happens is one of us in the room, and it's like, who is going to be, is, you know, we're humans, right? We naturally just kind of pull back. So we flinch and pull back. If you pull your hand back and the teacher misses your hand, then you're going to get twice. You get two. Yeah, so that happened a few times. So what we do is, a lot of us do, is we take the other hand and we grab our wrist just to hold it in place and then look away. But then if we look away, we don't know if the teacher is pointing at us. So it's like, oh, so that's traumatic, right? That's how I learned the times table, by just, it was literally beat into us. I don't joke about that. That's just, yeah. So it's terrifying. I remember missing it a few times, or, you know, I'm just taking my time, just trying to figure out what it is. And right. It didn't come out fast enough for the teachers. And then I got hit.
What an interesting, like, connection to fluency, like that, you know, what an interesting connection to thinking about how you learn something and to thinking about how your relationship with math developed, right?
Like, right. Yeah. And so I don't know if that's why I'm literally scared. I mean, I freeze up anything. There's time when something is timed, even games like Kahoot, which is very popular among teachers, right? Kahoot games. When I'm playing a game, I don't know, all those apps. And if there's a time factor, I just lose it. I give up. I don't even try anymore. So that's how, I don't know if that ties back to being hit, but something, right? It's a pretty good evidence.
I would say there's probably a link.
All right. Well, so I think math, back to the math fluency, it's quite similar to language fluency, right? It's doing mathematics with a flow. Not fast. I didn't say fast, but flow. It's like fluid. So it's having confidence in knowing efficient and accurate ways to compute. It's being flexible in one's thinking and applying strategies. And school math, I want to say, seems to tie fluency more to basic facts and computation. And this is evidenced by the explicit language that I see in the grade level standards, right? I mean, I don't recall, I don't know if you correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't recall seeing fluency standards in high school. So which further sends a message that, hey, you're in high school now, you should have these procedures down, right? So it puts a stop to fluency. To me, that just seems, when it's not mentioned as often, you know, you should be fluent in high school and in upper grades. And I think that's just something, I don't want it to be that way. I don't want that to be the case. I think you can always learn new strategies and learn more efficient ones. So the intersection for problem solving that you brought up, I think, you know, the three words that we always use to describe fluency, right? It's efficient. We want to be efficient with problem solving so we don't get bogged down in too many steps and lose track of our reasoning. And we certainly want to be flexible. Inflexible in problem solving, just like in fluency, is knowing more than one strategy, knowing more than one approach. That way you can choose, right? In order to pick the right one, we have to have more than one to choose from. And also, we might use one strategy to problem solve and a different strategy to check the result. And then the third word we use to describe fluency, that you can also describe problem solving, is to be accurate, right? So of course we want to be accurate during problem solving. We want to do careful. That means careful recording, mindfully systematic in our recording, and always double checking our work. I mean, all of those habits of mind, or just those qualitative measures, apply. If I take all the problem-solving strategies, or the common problem-solving strategies, and put it side-by-side with fluency strategies, right? They're side-by-side, they're quite similar. For example, a very powerful problem-solving strategy is to do a simpler problem. And fluency, that's what we're doing when we're decomposing and breaking up numbers, right? To do a simpler problem. Another one is working backwards. In problem solving, it's helpful to sometimes think about applicable to use working backwards. And that's inverse operations. You know, I might add in a subtraction problem. I'm adding, I'm moving forward. You know, all these inverse operations. Make a table. in problem solving. That's literally the organization of the times table, right? And then this one I love. This is from Joshua Zucker. I love this strategy for problem solving. It's called wishful thinking, right? The problem is difficult. We're not quite sure. So we wish it were this part, or we wish this constraint wasn't there. We wish this, we wish that, so that we can control some stuff, make it easier. And that's just when we do influency, right? I, for example, don't multiply by 7 ever. I don't. There are many. Honestly, if you ask me to multiply a 3-digit or more, I stop at 2. If I take a 3-digit number, if I had to multiply by 3, I will multiply by 2 and then add that whole. You want me to multiply by 4, I do double-double, right? I tell my students this. I don't multiply by 5. I multiply by 10 and then I divide by 2, because those are just easier operations. So that's what I mean by wishful thinking is we do a lot of rounding. If I had to multiply by 8 and 9 tenths, okay, that's a little taxing on my brain. I'm going to try multiplying by 9 instead, or by 10 and take away that kind of thing. So just a ton of strategies. And for me, it's fun because it's fun to play. Why not? Why not play with the numbers in that way?
The language that you're using to describe problem solving, you talk about those elements of fun. I love I haven't heard, you said Josh Zucker's wishful thinking. I hadn't heard that idea of, well, imagine it in another way, right? And I'm imagining the strategies that students are using to solve problems and using derived facts, using known facts to figure out facts that they don't know. And when I'm thinking about students in my class, or when I'm thinking about games that they're playing, students are actively, like, I want them actively playing around with the numbers, right? And trying out, well, let's see if that works. Or how did you think about that? And sharing their strategy. And those conversations that are happening in fluency practice, I so see that connection to problem solving, because in problem solving, I want my students to think about, well, what did you use to solve that? Or what do you understand about the problem? And how did you get that part? Or where did your thinking come from? And those conversations and that meaning making, it the playfulness with which you talk about problem solving, I think 100% it's so often missing from fluency practice. And so I love those links that you're building.
Yeah. I think it often feels like that fluency is there to support problem solving is how it's often positioned, where kids need to be drilled on their basic facts and have everything down to automaticity, and then they can engage in some problem solving experiences. But like Bethany said, it's really nice to see the bi-directionality here, where you can inject elements of problem solving into fluency, how they can support one another. If you had, any kind of way, other ideas to inject that energy of problem solving into fluency work, I'm sure we'd love to hear it.
Well, first, I want to mention what you said earlier about, that you have to be fluent in order to problem solve. And I unfortunately hear that a lot. And actually, people would just directly say to me, how does my student be able to engage in this problem if they don't know their facts? And right. I think out of all the things that I hear, that one breaks my heart. It really breaks my heart, because somehow we're equating computational and memorization with be able to think, be able to enjoy mathematics, right? And then the intersection between problem solving and fluency is symbiotic. If I can think of it that way, right? One helps the other. It really, you don't need, it's not a prerequisite. And if anything, when you have a kid engage in the problem-based, that engagement, right? We want kids to be interested in the problem. Then that would just bring out, now they're interested, now they want to spend time working on something. And then so, one should be playing off the other. And I remember in Dr. Staley's podcast, I really appreciate hearing you say, Dan, about the binary, right? That when we say that the kids can do this or not be able to do something. And I think, where is the progression when we say they can't do something? That's just That just makes me just want to die, because it's such a heavy label that you can't do something. I mean, I know we say that as adults often, but when we're labeling children that they can't do something, and something such as fluency, which is supposedly take this lifespan, right? This K through 12 at least. And again, I keep mentioning Dr. Staley just because that's the last episode I listened to, and I so much appreciate everything he said. He mentioned the story, right? Math as a story, and how is this vertical, how mathematics is more vertical. And then we owe it to the children, right? We owe it to the kids that they get the time to process. And it just seems, yeah, it's like, what? They can't be exposed to this interesting problem just because they don't have their number facts.
Yeah, my feeling is that when people say that students can't do a particular problem-solving experience, it's often because of poor design of that experience, not because of any kind of limitation on the kids themselves. Like students, right. Kids, people are all sense-making mammals. Like they look at things and make sense of them without even having to in lots of ways. And when, you know, I've worked on some of the problems that you've produced for people, mm-hmm. like they are visual. They propose a question without even really needing to state it out loud. For right. instance, they invite me to experiment and to push things around and see what happens next, to talk to people. These are all just like basic fundamental, you know, attributes of being alive and as a human. These are very like natural competencies. We're not talking about knowing, you know, the long division algorithm here, which is different, of course. So I'm just wondering, I guess, like when we think about the kinds of drill sheets that people often produce and other kinds of fluency experiences that students could be having that involved everything I just mentioned that's in your problem solving work, you know, experimentation, visuals, et cetera, communication. Like what are ways that those attributes can be transferred onto fluency exercises? Have you seen any? Have you produced any that you think capture elements of problem solving better than the fluency exercise worksheets do?
I mean, right. There are really smart worksheets, And I don't get to see them often, but they're smart because they focus, they have the kids focused on, it's called variation. I might be familiar right. with it. It's a term, right? It's variation, where it's not just a bunch of variety of problems, but it's smart practice because it's having kids honing onto one thing that's different, right? So those are wonderful. I mean, worksheets are not bad. Tests are not bad. It's what's on there. You know, right. It depends on the content and the context of it. But yeah, I mean, you can turn a numerical task into problem solving. So I'm less of, you know, those non-routine. I used to really love those non-routine tasks, but I think you can take anything from the textbook, from text, and turn that into problem solving simply by when and how you introduce it. When, if you just do it earlier, prior to teaching it, there you go. It becomes, right? So if I gave you a multiplication problem, so it's an exercise for us. But if we gave a multiplication problem to a child who has not learned it, that's problem solving. So there's that. There's that basic, just, you know, the definite problem solving simply means I don't quite know how to do this, but I understand multiplication, or I understand repeated addition. I understand something about it, right? And you can put it in context, but it's just all around us. You don't have to search far. I think the degree to which something becomes problem solving is simply how familiar we are with it, whether we have a prescribed set of steps.
I'd love to push a little bit more on this right here, where like if I gave a calculus question to a third grader, like that would be earlier than they'd been taught it, obviously. And but like it wouldn't feel like a problem solving experience, I would imagine, so much as an experience of frustration and futility. Right. So I think that there's like maybe something extra I'd love to hear from you about what makes the experience a problem solving experience.
I'm going to steal what Terence Tao, I heard him say once, and I love that. He said, just out of reach. Just like, so it's right there, just right there. Right. So, for example, I've been in elementary classroom where the teacher says they haven't learned multiplication yet. So I thought, okay, that's perfect. That's what I'll do. Right. They'll learn about area in the spring. I'm like, perfect. I'll do that in the fall. It's just they're gonna get to it soon enough. But I just know they have enough, so that it becomes problem solving.
I think about in you know, particularly like thinking about work with Megan Franke and cognitively guided instruction, I've seen so many examples of students who, like, for instance, in conversation, not in like a specific rote assessment, but in conversation, saying to a student, like even my kindergarten students saying, you know, you have 3 packs of gum and in each pack is 4 pieces. Like, how many pieces of gum do I have? Right. Yeah. And looking at I'm not expecting the student to use multiplication, right? But thinking about how does the student solve it and what are they using to solve that problem, right? And so Sometimes students are saying, well, I know 4 and 4 is 8. Or they're, you know, we have tools on the table. And so students are sometimes pulling out the tools. Or another example that I do in my fluency work, a problem, we have Dr. Guarino on the podcast. And we had worked with my students on this problem where Dr. Guarino has 5 bunnies in the hutch. Sometimes the bunnies are inside the hutch and sometimes the bunnies are outside of the hutch. What are all the different ways the bunnies can be, you know, she could come out and see the bunnies, right? And there are ways that students could solve it that, I mean, they could make up, you know, equations, all sorts of things. I'm sure there are very advanced mathematical, you know, that you could extend from 5 bunnies to 1,000,000 bunnies, right?
Like, and Bethany, that's the kind of lesson that I lose sleep. I mean, I am so excited. I lose sleep.
Yes.
I can't wait. Because what you're saying, I can't wait to see their strategies. I mean,
yes.
I think that's, you know, my blog will you know, if anybody reads my blog, it's just those types of lessons that it's just, I can't wait to share this because it goes in a direction that I'm super proud. It's, you know, I don't want class to end kind of thing. You know, I've done, you know, Dan's, the taco cart brings to mind, just penny pyramid, just those things where, you know, there's some calculus problems, but no, we can do what we can do. Right, we can do, and they can take it as far as they can. But just so right there, it's problem solving when it's just a little outreach.
But I give those examples too because as you're talking about the link between problem solving and fluency, I'm feeling like, let's say I'm doing that problem in my class. What I think I hear you saying is, then you're attending to the strategies that students are using or the meaning making that students are using. And are you saying that then that can be transferred to the way that they're building fluency? Or are you saying fluency is happening as they're...
Both. I want to say both.
Yeah. I'm imagining that the teacher that's listening to this and thinking about their fluency work is solved, right? They're hoping to develop fluency in a way that will support problem solving. And I'm wondering, you know, I love hearing the way you think about those links.
Yeah. So for example, if by engaging that task and with classmates, right, they're always doing these in groups, when they see they're motivated by when the group's strategy says, oh, we're building this table and they can hear. I mean, when we, especially when we randomly group kids, they will know who has what facts, right? And then when it's helping each other out and they say, okay, you know, I'm doing this. My way. I'm doing this my way, but somebody else next to them is like, oh, I'm doing this way. So hopefully, you know, they're seeing the efficiency, right? They're seeing, oh, that's more efficient. And that's where the number talks come in also. It's so powerful. The number talks, I think the most powerful thing about the number talks, which is mental math for me when I say number talks, is the shared strategies. The shared strategies is my favorite part. Not just because, okay, I'm hearing different things, but the best part is they're saying, I just learned a new way. Bethany did it this way. Oh my gosh, I just learned it. And then the next time they name it after you, Bethany. So I started Bethany's way, or I really like how Dan started the problem and I started the same way. So it's, we have mathematicians, right? Have names and they're sitting right in front of us, all of them. And that's empowering. We talk about wanting to empower the kids. How do they know that they have a place in mathematics? It's only because they have a voice. And so the number talks not just in the fluency skills, but building those skills build confidence, but also just the fact knowing that they have a voice is one feeds off the other, right? When you're this good, and then when you're told, yay, you know, you're applauded, you're respected for your thing, and that just, it just feeds on its own. And then now you want to work more on that. So there's that balance. Whereas a worksheet doesn't do the same thing for you. It doesn't give you that feedback that other classmates can give feedback to. In addition to number talks, which I do as warm-ups every other day, by the way, we do number talks every other day. And, you know, I always encourage teachers to always ask for estimates all the time because that builds number sense and play games. And I know you had Jennifer on the live session. That's fun, right? And so play games, strategic games like she had. And then I want to also mention that numeracy routines, because numeracy is part of fluency. That's important. I think that's why fluency is such a bigger category for me. And one of my favorite activities with fluency also is different bases, working other than base 10. And James Tanton's exploding dots come to mind. When kids learn, you know, to work in base 5, base 3, all of a sudden they really pay attention, especially in the decimals unit, right? And now we get to the decimals and it's like, yeah, it's on our base 10 system. What if we were, you know, an alien dropped in and they only function in base 7, that kind of thing. So school-wide, nothing should happen in isolation. Right? I don't want math to just happen within the math classroom. We want that to be far-reaching as much as we can. So I was thinking, you know, I would love to have, you know, schools adopt where over the PA announcement that happens every morning, that they maybe just end with a mental math problem. Just toss it out there. And whatever class wants to pick it up, pick it up. But it has that school kind of theme, that community sense. And newsletters home, encourage parents to play with mathematics with their kids. And just school-wide things. And, you know, I would love to start a staff meeting with a number talk. Really, just drop it everywhere you can. Because once you promote something so that it's natural and, you know, it becomes embedded and it's not, oh, I'm going to math. I only do this in a math class. It really should be borderless.
Fawn, I really appreciate you adding those agenda items for, you know, the Fawn Wynn School of the Future that you'll be running at some point.
Just a little bit more.
Well, I love that the way you're talking about those ideas, Fawn, are you're not talking about something that requires massive overhaul of like school systems or massive budget reallocations. These are things that you could start incorporating. And, you know, I feel like the work that what I've heard you talk about, I've heard you talk about work like not only in the school, but at district levels. And, you know, we're three math educators, all based in California. And, you know, California has a brand new math framework, which it's going beyond just fluency, but it places a greater emphasis on real world application.
Right.
And so I'm curious, what stands out to you in the new framework as you start to dive in?
There are several things. One of the key things, and I really applaud the framework, is it's the most equity-based, focused recommendations, right? And we are in a state, we have 6 million students in the state, so I'm glad equity is at the forefront. Also, the advocates for collaborative, inquiry-based learning, and I think back to the binary, I'm hearing it around Twitter in terms of, you know, it's direct instruction versus where it's a blend. And so I'm glad to hear that, no, we're not saying it's one or the other, but it's problem-based. But that doesn't mean it's all just, you know, give a kid a problem and let them go at it. But it has directed instruction also. And because of the push, for collaborative inquiry-based learning, and along with the equity-based, it makes this very wonderful promise that we will support all students from diverse backgrounds, include English learners like I am, and neurodivergent learners, to know that we all belong in a math class. Another thing that the framework does is the big ideas, right? The big ideas is a big thing, and we have data science along with the fluency. But the data science, the math content itself, supports the equity-based in a way that when the students can examine the important issues and address the inequities that they may see in their own communities. So that part is wonderful. I think what we all need now is what we've always needed is the teachers providing that support, because it took a bunch of years, right? 3-4 years for that to get finalized, get approved. And we need to focus on providing teachers with the support, not just in the pedagogy, but the math content to bring that framework to life.
Yeah, right. The framework, I mean, it's just always so interesting when these documents come out, the Common Core, the Math Framework, and others. Like teaching is the single largest profession in the U.S. There's just so many teachers of so many different capacities, and from novice to veteran, from, you know, people who have math degrees and who don't, who are generalists and specialists and so on. And it really, it's a very lovely marker to put out there, a flag on the ground is my feeling about it. And now I'm left to wonder, yeah, so how do we back those words up with deeds, with, like you said, Fawn,
right,
with, you know, the pedagogical support for teachers, and what good is pedagogical support if the teachers don't have useful materials to work with that bring out right. from students, that invite from students. So it's
exactly
the work is just beginning here is what it seems. But I love how you highlighted what's so good about this document.
Thank you. And this is something I read, and I just want and it sticks with me, and I love, and I don't know who said it, but I love it. It says, it's not that students don't need math. It's that math needs students, right? All of them. Math needs students. Because we always say, you know, you need math to do this and that. I said, no, mathematics needs kids, needs humans, all of them.
Shout out to, I think, Rochelle Gutierrez has made that a part of her messaging about mathematics. I love that.
I could have guessed that.
it matches, right? Thank you so much for coming on the show and talk to us again about problem solving, fan favorite, but also how to link that up with fluency and help the two of those nourish one another rather than being kind of these competing priorities in a class. It's been wonderful to chat. So thank you so much, Fawn.
Thank you, Fawn.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you guys always. Thank you. Thank you. Please. See you in real life soon.
Soon enough.
Thanks so much for listening to our conversation with Fawn Nguyen, specialist on the math teaching and learning team at Amplify.
If you folks are interested in delving deeper into the future of math in California, we're excited to announce that Bethany and I will both be a part of a brand new webinar series exploring just that. Beginning this February, you can catch the two of us hosting conversations as part of a free series all about math in California.
That's right. We'll be breaking down the new California math framework in greater detail. We're talking about building equity and engagement in California's math classrooms. And we'll answer all the questions you've ever had about authentic tasks and problem-based learning. Actually, Dan, we can't promise all of the questions will be answered, but we're going to do our best. I think together we can at least tackle a few of them, right, Dan?
Yeah, let's do it.
For more information and to register for the webinars, go to amplify.com/CAMathWebinars. That's amplify.com/CAMathWebinars, all one word. And we're also going to put a link into the show notes. And speaking of show notes, that's where you can find links to follow Fawn and watch her first appearance in the Math Teacher Lounge way back in season 2. Next time on the show, we are wrapping up our fluency-focused season. We're going to be talking about what we've learned, what questions do we still have, and try to synthesize some of all these amazing thought leaders and what we've learned together. Find that episode and everything else we've done this season in the Math Teacher Lounge feed, wherever you get podcasts. You can find more information on all of Amplify's shows at our podcast hub. Go to amplify.com/hub.
Thanks for listening.
Bye.